Get in the game at Albertsons. We're kicking off the football season with big prizes. Look for Game On participating player tags, buy any three, and enter your code for a chance to win. Get Quaker Life cereal 13-ounce boxes, $1.49 each when you buy three. And Gatorade 8-pack 20-ounce bottles, $3.99 each when you buy three, plus CRB. No purchase necessary. Open to residents of Southern California counties listed in rules, 18 years and older. Ends January 9th, 2018. Enter code by January 12th, 2018. Rules at GameOnSoCal.com.
Blog Talk Radio.
Je vous écoute. Je vous écoute.
Live, several miles from Hollywood. It's Advice Goddess Radio. With nationally syndicated advice columnist Amy Alcorn.
You tell me.
You call from.
Je call from.
Hi, welcome. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Welcome to a very eye-opening show. Now, I look back on my childhood. My mother was an early adopter of what I call, in quotes, health food. She meant well, but she should have just been honest about the taste. Yoo-hoo, Amy, would you like a nice piece of Pritikin bread for your snack? Or would you rather go out and gnaw some bark off a tree? Now, we have a lot of conflicting information flying around in the media these days about what we should eat. And boy, can it ever be confusing about what is and isn't healthy for us, thanks in no small part to our government's terrible, non-science-based advice on what we should be eating. Well, tonight, a very special guest, Denise Minger, who first came to my attention when, as an English major with a penchant for stats, she took on a wee hobby, meticulously laying bare Colin Campbell's shoddy science in the massive China study on her blog, will be talking about what is and isn't good science in diet. Her flaying of Campbell went viral, and everybody who cares about solid dietary science took notice of her, including me. Now she's written a terrific book, Death by Food Pyramid, How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health, and that's what we'll be talking about tonight. Denise Minger will detail the disturbing history of the ruining of America's health, in large part by our government. She'll explain the simple ways the ordinary person can identify scientific distortions in the media, which is really, really helpful. And she will detail the nuances of science-based healthy eating, whether you're a vegetarian or a carnivore or something in between. So stick with us and get informed so you can eat what good science suggests will make you healthy. Hello, Denise.
Howdy, Amy. Good evening.
Hey, I'm so happy to have you. I'm such a fan ever since I saw that. So you just, I mean, this was what, a hobby? You just took this apart. It was so huge and meticulous what you did.
Thank you.
Well, tell us a little bit about it.
Sure. The China study?
Well, just what you did, what the China study, this was this massive study, and everyone said, wow, wonderful news. And you said, actually, not so wonderful, not such good science.
Mm-hmm. So basically my whole interest in this subject, I guess it really traces back to my early childhood because I went vegetarian when I was 7 years old, it was, I think, second grade. I almost choked on a piece of steak, and I really became phobic of anything with a meat texture after that. So I just went pretty much vegetarian overnight when I was at a very young age. My parents were pretty much supportive of it and kind of just let me do my own thing. And so it was a full decade before I would ever eat meat again. So I spent a big chunk of my life growing up just avoiding meat and thinking that vegetarianism was healthier, that animal products were very bad for you. And it, within that stint of vegetarianism, I actually spent a good deal of time being a vegan as well. So when I was about 14, 13 or 14, I stopped eating dairy because I was kind of sensitive to it. So, you know, I'd react to it when I'd eat it. Stopped eating dairy. I thought that eggs were very bad for you because of the cholesterol, so I pretty much stopped eating them as well. And then when I was 15 years old, I went raw vegan, completely 100% strict, no animal products, no cooked food. And we can talk a little bit more about that experience later, but basically it fed into my whole belief system of animal products being bad for you because I was surrounding myself with people who were preaching this message of animal protein being bad, saturated fat being bad, cholesterol being bad. And I've always been kind of health aware just because I was never in great shape when I was growing up. I was always very sick. So health has been important to me, and it's been on my radar perhaps earlier than it had it arrived to most people. So anyway, with the China study, what happened was after I went omnivore, after being a raw vegan and my health failing and all that, I'd go back onto vegan message boards and just talk to people who are having kind of the same health problems that I had encountered during my period as a vegan. And instead of the positive reaction that I kind of expected people to have when I was trying to reach out to them, what I found instead were that people would just throw down these pat answers to me whenever I would say animal products improved my health. They would respond with something like, no, that's not true, because this book, The China Study, says that you're wrong. It says that animal products are terrible for you. This guy has a lot more credentials than you. Therefore, I'm believing this man instead of you. And time again, the answer I got to every, possibility I raised about animal products potentially being good for you was greeted by this answer of, just read The China Study and it will prove you wrong. And I had actually seen The China Study before and read most of it when I was I can't remember how old I was. I think it was after I'd stopped being a vegan, but I didn't find its arguments that compelling. Just from a logical standpoint, I didn't think that the idea that animal protein is horrible for you really jived with human evolution or my own experience or what just logic dictated. So I was very curious why this book seemed so convincing to so many people and whether or not the author really was correct. So it's kind of a big life story, but I was basically in a car accident when I was 21 years old, or 23 maybe, the early 20s. I got hit by a car, ended up laid up for a while I was healing from a shattered elbow, and I ended up in a situation where I had some insurance money that I could live off of for a while, and I didn't have to work for about 3 months, and I decided that instead of filling that time with traveling like I had originally intended, that I would just be a super nerd and get a hold of the original data of the study that the China study was its namesake was, and just do my own analysis of it. So what I ended up doing was I grabbed this copy of a book called Diet, Lifestyle, and Mortality in China, and it's 900 pages of just pure numbers that were gathered by these researchers in the 1970s and 1980s, and this is the stuff that the China study book is based on. And it's so for anyone who doesn't know what the China study is, it's basically this giant observational project that they conducted in 65 rural counties in China. And so some investigators from Oxford, from Cornell, and from the Chinese government joined up together, went into these rural counties, and basically studied, I can't remember how many variables, but it was a whole lot. I think it was 366 or something like that, 367 variables related to people's dietary habits, their drinking habits, their smoking, their lifestyle, their blood markers, their urine samples, just the whole spectrum of anything you could find related to health. And these people were surveyed, sampled, and basically just recorded in this giant compilation of data. And after this compilation of data...
Denise, just to sum up, didn't this, the upshot of this, because I want to get into, you have so much wonderful stuff in your book,
sure.
was that animal protein ruins your health?
Right. So yeah, that was the researcher's conclusion from the data he compiled. And the guy who wrote this book, The China Study, a man named T. Colin Campbell, his entire thesis was that animal protein, based on this giant study as well as some other stuff he pulled together, is deadly. He made the argument that it causes cancer, that it causes heart disease, that it contributes to osteoporosis, to diabetes, to all of our Western diseases that we're seeing today. And in his book, it seems very convincing because, again, he has all these credentials. He's, I think, a professor emeritus at Cornell right now, and he seems like a very trustworthy source. And so his very stern argument was that animal protein itself is a toxin, essentially.
And so one of the things I really admire you is that you're not only a dietary sleuth, but you talk about how in your book that most of us grow up in, you write, strapped in an educational system that favors obedience over independent thinking, and we have way too much respect for authority. You showed none of that. And also another thing I admire is that you have been eating this way. We tend to do things that bolster our self-esteem, and we want to believe that we're right. And instead of doing that, you did a real investigation. And you do this throughout your book, and I should tell people, your book is called Death by Food Pyramid, How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. I'm talking with Denise Minger, the author. And so some of this started in our country, which I find fascinating, with George McGovern and a staffer who worked for McGovern with zero science background. This is how our food pyramid came to be. So just, I want to get into the history of that a little bit, and then we'll get into some of the ways that we should and shouldn't eat and what is and isn't good science.
Sure thing. So in the late 1970s, America was really facing this crisis in terms of health and in terms of how much money was getting funneled away from Congress trying to do all this new healthcare stuff for these diseases that were emerging that had never been huge problems before. You know, things like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, cancer were on the rise. And so basically the government said, well, okay, we need to figure out a way to keep the cost down on this healthcare stuff that's going on. And at the time, Senator McGovern, he had been heading a committee that was in charge of solving America's hunger issues. And so he was already kind of working with diet. But he ended up shifting the focus of his committee towards new dietary goals for the United States. And so this document, Dietary Goals for the United States, it was produced in 1977. And as you just mentioned, it was written essentially by people who had very little to none in terms of scientific background. Their entire message behind what the recommendations were based on a handful of hearings that they engaged in. It was based on some research they had done into wartime diets where people had apparently had less heart disease during World War II. And so the logic became, well, if they had less heart disease then, maybe what they're eating during wartime rationing is the way we should be eating now, because that will then give us less heart disease, which, you know, there's a lot of other things that are going on during the war that probably affected mortality rates. But that was kind of the logic at the time. And so McGovern became famous for creating this document that was essentially the first time Americans had ever been told to reduce their intake of fat, of cholesterol, of salt, and in some sense of sugar, although the food industries really clobbered the committee into making a lot of changes in terms of conceding that, okay, maybe you can actually eat some refined grains and you can eat some sugar, because, of course, those industries are very powerful. But that's the short version of the dietary goals, and that was released in 1977, and it basically set the nation on a low-fat course.
Well, one of the things that's sort of amazing, too, is that you talk about how the USDA, as Marion Nestle, who is the chairman of Nutrition and Food Studies at NYU, wrote that, or she said to the Washington Post, the USDA is in the position of being responsible to agriculture and business. Nutrition isn't their job. And then, you know, and this is probably how hard-to-place foods like potato chips qualified as vegetables. And you
right.
said, your books were actually very funny in places. You said, asking the agriculture department to promote healthy eating was like asking Jack Daniels to promote responsible drinking. And so we had the food industry weighing in on the dietary guidelines, and they were just not created in science. But this is how we've been eating for decades, and Americans have gotten fatter and fatter, more diabetic, more unhealthy. And so a lot of the stuff, it turns out, that we were told not to eat is stuff we should eat, and vice versa. And one of the examples you give, you know, we were supposed to cut lard, no more lard, which actually is good for us, and we were supposed to eat these polyunsaturated oils. And that's actually,
right.
that's one example. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that was a bad idea. It was a really bad idea. Essentially, for anyone out there who's not familiar with Ansel Keys, he kind of spearheaded the anti-saturated fat movement starting in the mid-last century when he was also looking at wartime data, looking at how disease patterns have shifted. He set into motion the idea that...
I want to back you up. Ansel Keys,
sure.
We should tell people who he is, but I want to get in a little bit to the fats. Maybe we need to say who Ansel Keys is. He's a researcher who developed the K-ration in the 1940s, and he
right.
led up to this. But I just wanted to give people that example of the fats, because so many of us, canola oil, my mother, she got all these things before anybody did, and she thought that was at the forefront of health, but it's actually not. We'll get to the history, but maybe
right.
just to give people a sense of some of the stuff in your book that's so valuable, because you really sort of lead us back from the led astray and into what we should be eating.
Right. Yeah, so the whole stuff with fat, it was based on this idea that, well, polyunsaturated fats seem to lower cholesterol levels, and saturated fat seems, in certain studies, to raise cholesterol levels. And we all know that high blood cholesterol is an immediate ticket to, for a heart attack, you know, which is actually not the case at all. But basically the whole idea that we should be eating these polyunsaturated fats was based on just their cholesterol-lowering properties. And unfortunately, they have all sorts of other effects, including increasing the oxidation of your LDL particles, which is actually another contributor to heart disease. And so this myopic focus on cholesterol levels, especially total cholesterol, it really has done America a disservice because it's influenced what kind of drugs are on the market right now. It influences our entire setup in terms of diet because the government is basically trying to steer everyone on a cholesterol-lowering diet despite the fact that that kind of diet is often very low in nutrients.
And so these fats, what's wrong with the safflower oil? I see them listed on science blogs as PUFA, P-U-F-A, polyunsaturated fats, that we're supposed to have. We hear about omega-3 and omega-6. What kind of oil and fat should we be consuming to be healthy, and what should we not be consuming?
So the kinds to kick out of your diet immediately are the ones that are dominated by omega-6 fats. And those are basically most industrially processed seed oils, which include canola oil, corn oil, cottonseed oil, definitely soybean oil, sunflower seed oil. Those really cheap oils that are basically invading every single packaged product out there in your grocery store. Those foods tend to be extremely high in omega-6 fats and very low in omega-3 fats, along with just being very high in PUFAs in general. And the fats that really seem to support long-term health, both, especially if we look historically at what kind of populations were thriving, those include tropical oils like coconut oil, palm oil, definitely saturated animal fats. Those traditional animal fats have been used for a very long time among very healthy populations, things like lard, tallow, and butter, you know, from very high-quality dairy is excellent as well. And then in terms of other oils, omega-3 fats from marine foods, seafoods, fatty fish, across the board seem to have very positive effects.
And can you tell us about the difference, omega-3 and omega-6? Why is one good for you? Why is one bad for you?
I wouldn't put them in terms of good and bad. I would say that the ratio between them is very important. Most of us today have just way too much omega-6 in our diet, and that's largely because of those seed oils that are prevalent in everything. But omega-6 and 3, they both have important functions in the body. Omega-3 tends to be really good at promoting cardiovascular health, neurological health, your brain. And omega-6 in high doses is incredibly inflammatory. And so when you have a diet that's dominated in omega-6 without balancing it out with omega-3, you end up with quite a few health problems and even increased risk of cancer, it appears.
And we'll get into the diet heart hypothesis, but these oils that you're talking about, let's see, I sort of lost my place. We'll move on to the diet heart hypothesis, because this is a little bit about Ansel Keys. Tell us about Ansel Keys and what this diet heart hypothesis is and how he got there.
Sure. So as you mentioned, he was a Minnesota researcher who had a very eclectic background. He did a whole bunch of stuff like working on boats and scooping bat poop in caves in Arizona for a while in his youth. And he ended up pursuing nutrition because he was observing a rapid rise in the number of men who were dying of heart attacks right after World War II ended. And so he ended up doing some research, first very crude stuff, just correlating different nations, their fat intake with their heart disease rates. And what he found was that it seemed like nations that were eating larger amounts of fat per total, like within their diets, they were experiencing a higher rate of heart disease among their citizens. And so one of his most famous graphs that has been reproduced all across the internet, mostly as a criticism of him, is this graph of 6 different countries, despite the fact that there were about 22 countries that had data available from the time. And so he took 6 countries and he created this graph showing an almost perfect upward curve between a nation's rate of heart disease and its fat intake. And he presented this graph at a conference in Geneva, World Health Organization conference in the 1950s. And at the time, he was basically laughed out of the conference. Nobody was convinced by what he showed. He didn't really have a biological a biologically plausible mechanism linking the fat intake with the heart disease, and essentially he left with his tail between his legs because he had expected that everyone would just go on board with his theory that fat is potentially causing heart disease. And instead of giving up on that theory, what he did was he dug harder and deeper and conducted some of his own studies on cholesterol, looked at more observational data, and eventually cobbled together this case against saturated fat in particular being a cause of heart disease. And it took a very long time for the scientific community to get on board with him. But what he did, which was kind of the sneaky part, was he ended up, joining the American Heart Association board and selectively kicked out people who disagreed with him and pulled in new members who agreed with him. And it was by that sneaky method that he managed to get the American Heart Association promoting a low saturated fat diet for the very first time for Americans. And
you note that these two researchers, Yerushalmi and Hilbo, actually found the more dietary fat people consumed, the longer they generally lived. And they looked at Key's methodology and they scolded that correlation doesn't equal causation. And so
exactly.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so those two researchers, they did a critique of that graph that he presented at the World Health Organization conference. They had both been in attendance and both were kind of suspicious of what Keyes had presented to them. And so, again, what they did, as you just mentioned, they took data from the other countries that he had left out. They kind of took a more holistic picture to say, okay, well, here this guy has examined fat in relation to heart disease, but are there any other variables that might also have a relationship to this disease? And what they found was that it was, yes, indeed, actually animal protein and animal fat had a higher correlation with heart disease, which would seem to be, in favor of saying we should all be vegetarian. But what they actually found was that in each nation's, basically their affluence, how well off the country was, how well they had defeated poverty, how much access to medical care these countries had, how much TV viewership they had, how many vehicles they had, all of those things were correlating with heart disease, and often in a much higher rate than fat itself. And so what this picture was painting was that it wasn't necessarily fat that was causing heart disease. It was the nations that could afford to eat more fat because they were more affluent were the ones that were getting more heart disease. And so that, of course, includes an entire cluster of other variables that can contribute to poor health outcomes when you move from an active lifestyle to a more sedentary one.
Right. And so this is really bad, this where it's really shoddy science when somebody excludes things like that. And you're right that Keyes actually found that altering dietary cholesterol only had minor effects on blood cholesterol. And the notion that cholesterol causes heart disease, dietary cholesterol, we're lacking proof for that, aren't we?
Right. The whole dietary cholesterol fear, it's incredibly non-founded on almost anything scientific. What we do see is that there's a small portion of the population that when they eat dietary cholesterol, their blood and cholesterol increases a little bit, but it's both HDL and LDL, so-called bad cholesterol. And so their cholesterol actually increases in a ratio that, according to our modern scientific understanding, would not increase their risk of heart disease at all. And this whole idea that dietary cholesterol is bad for us, the biggest problem with that is it's made us kick out so many wonderful foods from our diets, things that are incredibly nutritious, like fish eggs, egg yolks, organ meats. Just because they're high in dietary cholesterol, we're told they're unhealthy, but in fact, they are actually some of the best foods that we could be eating.
And in fact, I know that cholesterol is protective. We don't want to lose to not have cholesterol in our diet, cholesterol-containing foods. And so this is very damaging. This all the food pyramid stuff that we were fed for decades actually has made America's health far worse, it seems.
Right. Yeah, definitely didn't do us any favors.
Right. I mean, but this is so incredible. Here's our government putting this out because, well, for one reason that you mentioned, it made food costs cheaper for people who are on public assistance. It helped people who were big companies, big agribusinesses. And we had potato chips qualifying as vegetables. I mean, they made fun of Reagan for ketchup. But I mean, ketchup's probably more nutritious than potato chips. It's just really incredible. And so there's been this recent backlash, people doing much better science and fighting back against it. There's a very strong belief. People want to believe that their government has their best interests at heart. And you're right. you know, in terms of one thing you're very strong in is the scientific thinking, and you say that confidence isn't always the best barometer of expertise. We've discussed this on my show before, but we tend to think it is, that these people, confidence or a title, you know, oh, is he an MD? Or you use the term, I'm going to try to find it, credentialphilia, believing somebody's more credible because they have a PhD. I mean, you did this amazing debunking. And I chose not to get a PhD so I could be transdisciplinary and use a lot of different stuff in my work rather than just studying, say, happiness or sexuality. And a really essential part of what you do and what scientific thinkers do is true scientific thinking. And I wanted to get into that a little bit because we read so many things in the media. I get so angry. Actually, the LA Times health, quote-unquote, health page is particularly bad. They promote these general interest reporters. Somebody was in Sacramento reporting on government. Oh, now you're a science reporter. And they don't know are essential to know. And one of them, and we've discussed some observational studies. When you see the term cohort studies, all of you who are listening, you should think, uh-oh. Tell us what a cohort study is and why it's easy to reach the wrong conclusion when you do one.
Yeah, sure. So a cohort is basically just a group of people who share a common characteristic or multiple ones. Often it's something like age or having a certain disease or living in a certain area. And so observational studies are often they often use cohorts in their analysis. But observational studies in general, it's the act of observing groups of people, or it can be a group of anything, but let's use people in this case, and just kind of watching them to see maybe what they're eating, what their lifestyles are like, and what kind of health outcomes they're having as the years roll on. And
Denise, just, but aren't these are often things where they just ask people, they have people fill out questionnaires and say, what did you eat last year? And I call them leaps to conclusions after the fact. So they fill out, some old guy fills out a study and says, oh, you know, I ate this kind of food and a bunch of other people ate it. And they say, oh, well, obviously eating this food causes your head to fall off. And they forget to look at, well, oh, did the person smoke? You know, I mean, what other factors were there? And so it's not the same thing as a very good randomized double-blinded study. So tell us about what makes up a good study. So if you see, I just want to tell people again, if you see cohort studies or observational study, and then they say, and red meat's going to make you grow a third head, or beans will make you, beans will make you do something very bad, that you need to really think, oh, I'm going to look at that skeptically, rather than these studies that are the gold standard studies, which are, tell us about them.
So randomized controlled trials are usually considered the gold standard, and that's because this is one of the only study types that can actually determine cause and effect. Like with the observational studies, as you just mentioned, you might find that the people who are eating a ton of meat and, you know, dropping dead of heart disease or whatever, maybe the ones who are eating a lot of meat are just the ones who just don't care about their health because they've been told by the government that they shouldn't be eating meat. And so they're like, well, I don't care. I'm going to smoke. I'm going to drink. I'm going to have my whiskey every night. I'm going to eat my hamburger every night. And so you can't really determine what's causing what. But with a randomized controlled trial, what happens is you take a group of participants, and the best way to do this is also to blind the study, which means people don't know which treatment is being given to which participant. And
that's the randomized part.
So the randomized part is people don't get to choose what group they're in. They are essentially, they're given maybe a randomized number and assorted into different groups based on that. Because if people select what group they're going to be in, that introduces the possibility of a bias in the study. So you really just want this whole thing to be completely random and to eliminate any chances of bias. And so randomized controlled trials attempt to do that in the most efficient way possible. So people are allotted to different groups and given a different treatment, like maybe they're given a different diet or a different drug, and the studies are supposed to be designed in a way where only one major variable is changing. And that way, if these people have a different health outcome based on that one changed variable, you know that was the thing that's causing that change and not one of the other confounders that are going on.
That's the controlled part.
Right, yeah, so okay. That's the control part, yeah.
I wanted to break those little parts up. I actually know what randomized means, but and blinded is so the researchers don't know who they're studying. So because you can, We all have biases, and we assume things when we know some kind of fact, we have some kind of context. So that helps it be honest on the researcher's side.
Right, exactly. Yeah, the researchers ideally shouldn't know which participants are getting which treatments. Doctors in particular, if they're doing diagnostics of their patients and they know that one person is eating a high-fat diet and another person is eating a low-fat diet, that might bias how they interpret the person's symptoms and their health outcomes. And there's just so many possibilities where things can just be influenced by people's preconceived notions and expectations. So a true scientific study, like one that really works in an efficient way, eliminates as many possibilities of bias as possible.
And now, what's correlation? We see that a lot in the media, correlation, and correlation versus causation we mentioned before.
Sure. So correlation is just when two variables seem to have some kind of relationship. Like, again, you might find that people who are eating more hamburgers each day are getting more of a certain disease, or you might find that people who are eating more kale each day are getting less cancer, whatever. It just seems like as one thing either increases or decreases, another thing either increases or decreases. So there's some kind of relationship between those two things.
And now, this is something that's come under some scrutiny in science lately, peer review. Tell us what peer review is and then how it can be a little bit problematic when it's not done as it's intended.
Sure. So peer review, at least in the academic setting, it's when scholars, they review the work of their peers and their colleagues who are creating studies and writing papers. And it's supposed to be kind of a quality control mechanism, just to make sure that, you know, you have multiple eyes scanning these research or these pieces of research that have been done. And the goal is to make sure that that research is accurate, that it has been correctly interpreted, that it's been conducted in a way that really is beneficial to the scientific community. And it seems like a great idea in practice. And for the most part, it is. But the problem is that a lot of our peer-reviewed journals out there themselves have a very heavy bias. And it's actually kind of frightening how many medical companies, pharmaceutical industries are funding a lot of our medical journals and our nutrition journals and having an influence on what kind of studies end up into the publication. And the other problem with peer review is that even researchers, even if you have a PhD, you come equipped with your own set of biases. And for somebody to research or conduct a piece of research and then someone else to review that research, if the person reviewing the research has their own expectations of how the world works, they are going to inflict that bias on the way they're reading the study. And it's really not a system that is perfect in any sense. And a lot of times, excellent papers get prevented from ever seeing publication in peer-reviewed journals, just because they don't mesh with the status quo.
Yeah, I think it's very important to recognize this, and this is why I wanted you to emphasize it, because there's something also, I work with this epidemiologist who sort of kicks my butt about how to read studies, seabed science, and he has often talked about publication bias, which is where drug companies especially will have a bad result in a study, and they'll just bury it, they won't publish it. And so that's something, and what he coaches me to do is to look for a body of work on a topic. That are there mm-hmm. many studies finding something similar? And that's really important. So when people see one study in the media that says, oh my God, your head's going to fall off if you do this ever again, well, okay, have other people found that too? And recognize also that many reporters do not have any training in science, so they are taking something off a press release. And you will find it's very hard to do. Denise, you do this so well. You have to go through somebody's math and all their methodology and see, okay, the stuff that they say is there, is it really there? Did they make a mistake? And it's pretty hard sometimes, medical studies especially, to pick them apart without being a math genius. Anthropology is easier, luckily. But you do that well. And there's something, too. This is a little bit harder. Talk about, this is something you see, absolute risk versus relative risk.
Right. So this is one of those things that the media has no concept of understanding that I think tends to fool the general public a lot. So risk is just the chance of something taking place. You know, that's a very simple term. But absolute risk and relative risk are two very different things. And what the media usually reports is something called relative risk, which is it's just a measure of seeing how much more or less likely something is to happen. And so if you see something that says, like, smoking, or sorry, maybe let's do meat eating again because that's my favorite one to use. Meat eating increases your risk of getting colon cancer by 30%. You hear stuff like that reported by the media so often. And the immediate impression it gives is something like, oh, if I eat meat, then I have a 30% chance of getting cancer, or, you know, something along those lines. But what it really conceals is the what's called the absolute risk, which is just the pure measure of what your chances are of getting a disease. So maybe a study finds that eating a piece of red meat every day increases, or like is associated with, an increased risk of colon cancer that goes up from like 2 in 10,000 to 3 in 10,000. And when the media reports that, it just takes a relative risk, which is that it goes up by a third. But in a realistic sense, you've really only increased the risk of getting this disease by 1 in 10,000, which in those terms does not seem as scary, which is that lack of drama using absolute risk is the biggest reason that the media does not report in those terms, because, again, the media's sole goal for the most part is to grab readership, viewership, scare people into reading an article, grab their attention, and give them something new and dramatic to look at. And for the most part, a lot of scientific findings are really not that exciting, so you have to dress them up a lot to make them seem important.
Right. Meat might kill somebody somewhere is a lot less important. You have a 30% chance of dying if you eat that steak instead of a big block of tofu. And,
right.
And actually, I want to mention something that you bring out. This is so important. For all those people who have vegans trotting out the meat will kill you links on their Facebook pages, you point out that those studies manage to differentiate between various cooking methods and generally show that the meat cooked at very high temperatures is largely driving disease associations. And so people who eat meat, like I do, I like to order it still mooing if I have a waiter. we're not likely to have the same effects as the people who eat it, you know, burnt to a crisp.
Right, yeah, that's the fascinating part. It's that it doesn't seem like there's something inherently evil about meat that just causes people to die. A big part of it is how the meat is prepared. I'm sure quality plays a big role as well. But, yeah, cooking method is a huge one, and it's actually the cooking of the meat that generates a lot of these compounds that we see associated with disease. And so I do the same thing. I eat most of my meat very on the mooing side, and I think that's a lot healthier for the most part, you know, unless you get, of course, like, food poisoning, but I've really not had that experience myself. But yeah, cooking method is a huge confounder, again, that we see in studies that is rarely accounted for.
Oh, you just used another word, confounder. What does that mean, confounder?
So a confounder is a variable that can influence the relationship between other variables. And often it can either create the illusion of two things.
Can you just, I'm just checking. This is the first time they're reading it. So confounder, tell us slowly.
So a confounder, so say you have two things you're looking at, like some kind of food people are eating and what they're dying of. A confounder is kind of an invisible variable that can influence the relationship between those two things and either make it seem like there is a relationship or maybe make it seem like there isn't a relationship. But in the case of talking about meat, for example, again, it might be the cooking method that actually is responsible for that link between meat and whatever disease you're studying. And so it's not, again, it's not the meat itself. It's that the meat is being confounded by the cooking method, essentially, and it's creating the illusion of meat itself being bad for you when, in fact, it's actually a very specific cooking method that's causing that damage.
And actually, you talk about why. You say that when you cook meat at a high temperature, there are these things called heterocyclic amines that form. This, you know, when amino acids, sugars, and creatine, which is a chemical in meat, react at high temperatures, and that it's important to cut off the charred portions before you eat them, and to use marinades. Sorry, I'm not from France. You call it H8, heterocyclic amines that form. So if you don't cook it at high temperatures and if you use a marinade, you're already ahead of the game.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, like gentle methods of cooking as well, like stewing. There's a lot of ways to prevent that from happening.
Yeah, you mentioned stewing as another one. That's to cook your meat slowly. I think that that's important. And I just want to hit on one more thing, that this is a huge pet peeve of mine. I love this. It's like the, okay, in my world, there's the research on oxytocin on prairie voles. Okay, unless you live in a hole and have whiskers that have claws and everything, little front teeth that gnaw, the oxytocin research on prairie voles may not apply to you. Let's not eat ours in your picture, you know, and you talk about rat studies and rabbit studies, some of the early studies, you know, that led to all this crazy stuff that we were advised to do that was so anti-science. There were studies by this Russian guy on rabbits, and rabbits, I believe that they, what is it, that they, they're herbivores, so that they, you know, and we're omnivorous, and so that they can't digest dietary cholesterol like we can. And so that's already, you know, it doesn't even apply to us. And so talk about this with these rodent studies. People need to look for that when a study is done on mice, or to look and see, you know, when people make this incredible finding, some reporter says something, look elsewhere, look up the study and see if there were rats involved.
Right. It's so funny how much rodent studies get immediate media attention. It doesn't make sense. But yes, a big reason we use rodents in our scientific studies is because they have such short lifespans. It's easier to see the effect of a certain food on them or a certain medication, opposed to a human who has a longer lifespan. And of course, we have a lot more ethical considerations if you're working with a human life. And the biggest problem I see with rodent studies when it comes to diet and nutrition research is that the foods they're fed are just atrocious. It's not like when you see something that like a rodent has been fed a high fat diet, you think, okay, maybe it's kind of like the Atkins diet that humans eat. No, what they're eating is a mixture of stuff like cornstarch, casein, isolated milk proteins, maltodextrin, soybean oil, corn oil, and then a bunch of vitamin supplements that are just refined and lab generated. It's really not actual food that they're eating. And the whole reason that researchers use these refined diets is because it's easier to control the variables in a tighter way. But for the most part, researchers don't actually try to gauge the effects of like a high-fat or low-fat diet on animal health. It's more a matter of making them obese with a diet that's very unhealthy for them, and then understanding the effects that obesity has on all of their various mechanisms in their body. And so whenever you see a rat study or a mouse study saying high-fat diet is going to make you have whatever disease or it's going to increase your risk of whatever, and again, it's using a mouse diet, you can be pretty rest assured that the diet they're eating is not anything similar to what a human in their sane mind would ever put in their mouth.
Right. And a part of the problem, too, is not just people reading studies, but, you know, going to the doctor. And I have to say, my primary care doctor, I just realized, you know, not to be rude, but she didn't really know too much in the way of recent science. I mean, there are big posters about eating grain up on her walls. I've had a number of people on my show talking about, you know, how bad it is for you to eat a high carb, low fat diet. And doctors don't read journals, many of them, after they get out of school. And so, you know, they're getting info from drug reps or basically from dietary hearsay. So it's really important, these things you're talking about, this is why I was so intent on focusing on these things about studies, because people need to know these things so they can at least get, you know, the information for themselves. And what I do, because I understand what is and isn't good science, so I can understand who does and doesn't do it, even though I don't work in the nutrition area and read these studies, which are very complex, because as I said, medical studies are harder to read. I see what you lay out, and I like Dr. Michael Eads and Mary Dan Eads, but Mike Eads does more of the scientific stuff at proteinpower.com. Gary Tobbs, who's been a friend of mine for years and first did an expose on salt, how salt isn't bad for you. He's actually the person I know in the world who's probably the most nervous about telling the scientific truth. I love that about him. But if you look at people like that and you give these examples, you say, okay, you know, are they, look at how they're telling you the story. A thing I admire about both Mike Eads and you is that you explain complex science in very simple terms. And, you know, you had this wonderful, wonderful bit on p-values on your site today, which are a complex thing from science. I have to always, I have this death book I look at, but that you explain them in ways ordinary people can understand. And you say that this is very, very important, that they're not obfuscating and they're not trying to revise the scientific method, you know, or exempt mm-hmm. themselves from following it, which actually leads to explain the scientific method.
So the scientific method, it's essentially a way of just figuring out what's going on in the world and testing observations. And it's usually listed out, like you can do it step by step. You know, you start with a purpose or a question about what's going on, what you're observing. You know, do some background research. You come up with a hypothesis, your own prediction about what's causing what. And then the exciting part, which is what you design an experiment to test what it is you're observing and test to see whether your ideas are correct or not. And then, you know, you conduct your experiment, you analyze it, you draw some conclusions. And what seems so unfortunate is that a lot of people skip some of these steps within the scientific process, the scientific method, and they'll do something like they'll observe the world around them, they'll come up with a theory, and they'll assume that because either they have a lot of educational background, because they have a PhD, because they think they're God, because whatever, they think that, okay, well, my ideas are right, so I'm just going to present them as the universal truth without actually going out there and maybe testing myself to see if I'm wrong. I think a great thing for anybody to do is try to disprove yourself, any kind of belief you have, and if you can't defeat it yourself, then, you know, your belief is pretty strong. But so many people in the scientific world just are more focused on proving themselves correct and getting their message out without being certain that they're actually telling the truth about what they've observed and perceived.
I just want to mention, too, that people's grants are often determined by a course of work. And if they mm-hmm. suddenly find, oh, my God, I was wrong about this, the money's going to dry up. So you have cases of people not coming out with the truth. Like I said about publication bias, it's often by drug companies, but individuals can do it as well. People are as self-serving in the sciences as they are because they're people in other areas. So it's really important. And I keep saying, you know, throughout your book, all this stuff, it just screams at me, be a skeptic, you know, to look at this, to look for, that's why the body of work helps. Like all these things that you talk about, to realize these things, that to not hold people up as gods, and also to look on the website. You know, we tend to believe that people are more valuable at something because they have credentials, which I don't believe because I've seen so many flaws. Really famous people in anthropology who have done mm-hmm. terrible science, and it's amazing. And they're famous because they're famous, and nobody really.
Right.
And you talk about this thing. Basically, my dog could get credentialed. Your dog, you write this book, nutritional consultant. You can get something from a diploma mail that sounds legit. And people have suggested that to me over the years because I used to feel sort of, oh, I don't have a PhD and other reporters, they won't respect me and everything. But, you know, it's just not the right thing to do, first of all. And I know I do good science, same as you know you do good science as an English major. And I should actually mention mm-hmm. your book again because we're discussing it. I haven't mentioned it for a while. Death by Food Pyramid. I love your laugh. Death by Food Pyramid by Denise Minger. And the subtitle is How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. And speaking of ruining our health, you know, vegetarians, and I am not one, and I sort of make fun of vegetarians and vegans in my column, and I'm sorry, but except that it's funny. And you write about some of the problems, actually, of being a vegetarian because there are some things missing from a diet that doesn't contain animal products. And Chris Kresser has a good post on this about vitamin B12. And some of these things, you say that vitamin A only exists in animal foods. There's no naturally occurring sources of vitamin B12 in plants. And then you talk about vitamin K, which helps put calcium in the right places, you know, in your bones and teeth, as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, arteries. It shuttles it out of there, you know, and, you know, it's found in, you say, certain bacteria and animal products like dairy and organ meats and eggs and fish eggs. And also there is natto, which is this Korean product that tastes like, you know, homeless wino's feet.
So most it's people so don't gross. Like,
that's so vegetarian, sorry. So, you know, what is a vegetarian to do to get these, to replace these products that they don't have in their diet because they aren't eating meat?
Well, the standard practice is to supplement, but unfortunately with a lot of the stuff, the food sources are much more bioavailable than anything you can take in a pill form. And really, I tell people who want to stay vegetarian, because I get a lot of people contacting me from my blog saying, I really want to be healthy, but I have these ethical considerations or religious or spiritual considerations, or I just cannot literally put a piece of meat near my face without gagging. And, you know, so I need to stay vegetarian for these reasons. How do I stay healthy? And I think the thing to remember is that vegetarianism and veganism, they are experiments on the human body. We've never had long-ranging vegan populations in history that have thrived and done well. And so whatever you're doing to your body today, just know that it's an experiment. Like, it's not something that you are evolutionarily equipped to handle. So you can make the best of that situation by supplementing. I say vitamin D is huge for most people, you know, omnivores as well. Vitamin D, of course, definitely supplement B12. There's some nonsense out there from some vegetarian communities saying that you can get B12 from the air or from, like, a tiny speck of dust that's on your vegetable that you didn't wash. Stuff like that. It's not true. You need it. I'm serious. Like, people say this. I facepalm so much it hurts my forehead. It's horrible. And so there's that, of course. And then I say for people who are trying to increase their vitamin A conversion from the carotenes they eat and things like carrots and sweet potatoes and orange-colored vegetables, try to eat some fat with those brightly colored vegetables that you're eating, because the fat can help your body absorb some of the vitamin A and help the conversion process, because unfortunately people convert carotenes from plant foods into vitamin A at different rates depending on what your genetics are and some other health variables. So for a lot of people, there's really no way to be vegetarian and get enough vitamin A, and that's just the sorry truth about the matter. But, you know, there's a lot of other stuff. There's, like, an amino acid taurine that's higher in animal products. Some vegetarians are supplementing with that. It's really just a question of, you know, what can your body take based on your own health history, your own kind of starting point when you began a vegetarian diet. Some people do well for a long time on vegetarian diets. Others crash and burn very quickly. And if you're one of the crasher and burners, you know, it's kind of a choice between saving your own health and having whatever animal consideration or ethical consideration or religious consideration that originally brought you to the diet. I'm really in favor of people. Yeah, sorry.
I was just going to mention, because you mentioned something about mollusks, and I was at a conference once, an evolutionary psychology conference, and Diana Fleischman, who's written on how it is moral to eat these non-sentient creatures, these mollusks, you know, clams and things, she came up to me and I was eating a meatball and she said, "Don't you care about the animals?" And I said, "Not enough to not eat them." And she said, "Well, it's not hypocrite." And she's actually written a paper on this, you know, because she's a serious vegan. We're friends and she's not one of the annoying ones. She's really smart and interesting. And she's written, people can look this up, Diana Fleischman, it's F-L-E-I-S-H-C-H, sorry. You'll find it, on mollusks. Eating mollusks and how it is ethical, then that's something you suggest, that people can get some of what they're missing, even if they don't eat something cute and furry with a face.
Right, yeah. I think oysters are incredibly nutrient dense, and they can supply a lot of the vitamins and minerals that are harder to get from plant foods alone. And they don't have a central nervous system. So if your consideration is that an animal feels pain when you kill it, oysters and other bivalves really don't fall into that category.
Now, you just mentioned words that were really important, nutrient dense. And this is something that you say, you talk about in these various ancestral populations and populations people have studied, that people eat these things, butter, and they eat organ meats. There are these very nutrient dense foods. And this is very important for us. And this is what you're missing actually on a vegetarian diet, because you just can't get all the proteins you need and the nutrient density that you do from a fatty piece of meat.
Yeah, absolutely. If we look at any, or not any, but probably most of the longstanding populations that really had a reputation for being strong and robust and long-lived and disease-free, they all valued certain foods within their diet and within their communities, things that there had been, ideas passed on from generation to generation saying that these foods are very valuable and you need to eat some of them, especially if you're, you know, pregnant, if you're a young growing child, if you have higher nutrient requirements. And those, again, the things like organ meats, there were bone broth, things made out of bone and cartilage and tissue, really high in glycine and amino acid from the gelatin. Fish eggs, egg yolks, dairy from cows that were eating rapidly growing grass, which tends to be higher in vitamin A and produce more vitamin K2. For the most part, it's all animal foods. You know, fermented plant foods as well played an important role for a lot of communities. But for the most part, there's just like some singular foods that tend to be, unfortunately, high in dietary cholesterol, so they've been booted from our diet, according to the government recommendations. But they're just incredible for supporting health.
But again, the dietary cholesterol, there is no evidence mm-hmm. that dietary cholesterol
no.
causes heart disease. And actually, we, because, you know, we're not so much eating these yucky things, the eyeballs and the brains and everything. we started getting this thing called, it's powdered, Great Lakes Bovine Collagen. And that's like, mm-hmm. I think, toenails or something. And you put it in the hot water, the green one, because that melts better. And they can get it cheaper, with collagen. But it's really important to add those things to your diet. You make those points because, you know, those are these things that really, really feed us. Another thing, just to tell people a little cooking tip, which is hilarious because I always joke that I don't cook, I heat. I don't make anything ever in an oven. My oven doesn't work. It would catch fire, I think, if we
changed
it once. But I make an omelet every day. I know this sounds gross, but I ate at this great Amy's Cafe in Traverse City. And they made me an omelet with foie gras with liver in it. And they don't sell foie gras in California anymore. But you can get sort of this, I guess, some kind of pate that's some kind of liver something. And it's really, really good. And so then you're getting that every day. And it's really fatty. And people think fat is bad. And I have learned after, you know, measuring with a, you know, micrometer how much fat and calories I had in my diet. Now I just eat until I'm not hungry anymore. And that in the morning, having that, the two little slivers of liver in my egg, in my eggs, it makes me feel energized until about noon, from about 9 to noon when I'm doing this intense cognitive work. And so I think people, you know, who are sort of, oh my God, how can I add fat to my diet? I'm really going to start eating this different way. Mary Denise, Dr. Mary Denise, she suggested something really interesting, which is try it for 3 weeks. Commit to trying something for 3 weeks. And you can do that. You can think like, okay, I'll try it and I could stop. And you know, all these things that you suggest in your book, which is Death by Food Pyramid, How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. These are all things, they're all, you back them up very well, cutting sugar. And one thing that you say that's very important, you say that, you know, these three most popular diets now, the paleo diet, the Mediterranean diet, and a whole food plant-based diet, you say that what these all have in common is that they lack modern, heavily processed foods.
Right. Yeah, it's fascinating because we see these different diets, and I think we get so confused because they seem so different, yet they all have adherents that are claiming so much success, often the same kind of success, like disease reversal or weight loss. And we think, well, that doesn't make sense. How, what does the paleo diet have in common with, you know, the vegan diet? And you look closer and you see that they have all eliminated things like those vegetable oils that are really high in omega-6 fats. They've eliminated refined sugar, refined flour, basically anything that's extremely modern and heavily processed. Those are not parts of those diets. And so I think it's a big clue that those foods are very much not welcome in a healthy body. If all these diets, what they have in common is the elimination of them.
And now I've learned from dietary researcher Dr. Jeff Volek, who's very good and has been on my show. He talked about eating protein but eating a lot of fat to balance it out. But this actually doesn't seem to be true for everyone. And you wrote about this. I'm probably going to say it wrong. APOE4, the hoarder allele that we have. Some of us have this bad allele, you know, and those people do best on diets that emphasize leaner animal products. And it's a nutrition profile, you say, resembling the protein-rich insects, small mammals, reptiles, go eat that possum outside, and scavenge fare encountered by our distant hominid ancestors in the days before food supply was more constant. So you're saying, okay, maybe intermittent consumption of saturated fat and cholesterol-rich foods works best for these people. And you have to get a medical test for this, but I would guess, this is just, you know, like, okay, well, what if you can't afford a medical test? Maybe a person who really has a hard time losing weight and tends to be overweight, even when eating a low-carb diet, they might try this, maybe try that leaner protein.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid process. It's definitely an expensive test to get. Another thing to look at is to see if you're a carrier of that particular gene variant. If you have a history of Alzheimer's in your family, that's a big tip-off that you might have inherited APOE4 because it's incredibly highly linked to Alzheimer's disease if you're a carrier. if you have a history of heart disease as well, that can be a big tip off. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a matter of not needing to avoid those foods completely, but maybe if you're eating bacon with every meal and your LDL is skyrocketing and it just looks like your blood lipids are really moving in the wrong direction, it might be a good idea to scale back on that and maybe just do intermittent fasting or just a more cyclic approach to eating very high saturated fat foods and just see what effect that has. Because if you look at history, we really haven't had access to an abundance of fatty food for every single meal of the day. There really has been a more kind of ebb and flow to the abundance of dietary foods in our lives.
Well, thank you. We're almost out of time. Can you just leave us any final brief words of advice?
Sure. For anyone who's really serious about, I guess, getting healthy, just question everything. Question yourself, question the news, question your authorities that you feel are trustworthy. You know, you don't have to wear a tinfoil hat everywhere, but the process of completely opening your mind and keeping it cracked at least a little bit open so that new information can get in and you can get rid of stuff that's not working for you, it's imperative. I think there's a big danger in clinging to information that's harming you and doing so just out of habit or out of fear. So just always question and strive to be a critical thinker.
Thank you, Denise Minger. That was a great show. I've been talking with Denise Minger, who is author of Death by Food Pyramid, How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. Denise, thank you so much. Great, great show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your Halloween parties are spooky good because you skip the supermarket and fly straight to Smart and Final, your Halloween headquarters. You want some candy? There's a whole aisle of candy, treats, pumpkins, party supplies, and spooktacular prices up to 25% lower than supermarkets. Plus, Foster Farms whole chicken or picnic pack are 89 cents a pound, limit 4 packs. And 64-ounce First Street 100% apple juice or cider, just 99 cents. Smart and Final for Halloween. Bring on the boo! Your Halloween parties are spooky good because you skip the supermarket and fly straight to Smart and Final, your Halloween headquarters. You want some candy? There's a whole aisle of candy, treats, pumpkins, party supplies, and spooktacular prices up to 25% lower than supermarkets. Plus, Foster Farms whole chicken or picnic pack are 89 cents a pound, limit 4 packs.